You are now part of a social experiment.
Welcome to Mastermind, the show where you learn to develop and master your skill from the best of the best. Here's your host, Mr. G.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today on the journey towards self-mastery. Our next guest is a human rights activist, community organizer, and veteran social worker with over 30 years of experience dealing with healing the Black community. He is the president of Mu'eed and Mu'eed Associates. He has a master's in social work from Stony Brook University and a doctorate in social work from the University of Southern California. He has credentials in alcoholism and substance abuse counseling, family development, and a license in mental health counseling. He has been an adjunct professor for Hunter College, Columbia University, Temple University, Lincoln University, and Teachers College. He's former co-chair of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. His work now focuses on social justice, human rights, African-centered social work, historical trauma, violence prevention, mediation, and conflict resolution. He's also the fatherhood coordinator for Healthy Start in Delaware County, a program that aims to educate the community on fatherhood and parenting, as well as reducing the maternal mortality rate. He is a consultant for the Cure Violence program that looks at violence as a health issue. Let's welcome today our community healer, Dr. Onaji Mu'eed, to the program. Dr. Mu'eed, how are you doing today, sir?
Listen, young man, I'm doing well. It's a pleasure and an honor to be in your presence.
The honor is mine, man. I had the pleasure and the honor of going through pretty much your life's work, man. And it really humbled me just to look at the amount of work that you have done for the Black community collectively in so many different areas, man. And, you know, I know people that get to a certain level after retirement or a certain age, and they're like, well, I'm going to let the young folks handle this, or, you know, pass it on to the next generation, and you're still doing the work, man. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for that. And I'm humbled to be able to speak to you today, man.
Thank you. I will just make a slight correction that currently I am the male co-chair of the Corporate Health Commission. I was the former co-chair of the International Commission, but currently I am the co-chair, the male co-chair of the Health Commission.
Got it. Man, and I do want to say to listeners, like, your resume is like, I didn't count the pages, but it got to be like somewhere like 8 to 10 pages, something like that. So please forgive me for that mistake. it was quite a lot. but yeah, man, definitely an honor, man. The amount of work that you've done, I'm sure, has just, you know, helped and saved so many lives in our communities, man. So definitely a pleasure speaking with you, man. And it's hard to even know where to begin because you've done so much. But your name is longer than what we presented in the intro. So can you walk us through the meaning of your name and why you changed it?
You know, naming is such an important thing for African people. And when you think about it, our people walking down the street, his name is John Lewis. His name is Alfred Brown, whatever. And we walk around with these names thinking like, that's their name. Well, the question becomes, how did you get that English name? These are English names. Could be Irish names, could be Italian names, but where did those names come from? How were they superimposed upon us? And to show you the level of deceit and confusion, it's not even a discussion. It's not even something to be noticed. But I tell you one thing, if you had a lot of white people walking around here with African names, you'd be looking at them like, what's with that story? His name is Babatunde, and you see another white guy, you see all these white people and all of them had these African names, you're like, this is very curious.
Wow, I've never thought about it like that before, man. Wow, that's really interesting, man.
But we walk around like this is the natural order of things. This is why Amos Wilson said that we must turn the world right side up because it's upside down. So my name, Onaje Rojo Jua Osundu Eagle Heart Abdul Moid is a really, it's a narrative of my life, the different stages I've went through, different things I learned along the way, different things that was taught to me. So Anaje is from Nigeria, Yoruba. It's also Swahili, means either Yoruba, it's owner of the feeling, Swahili, it's the sensitive one that I'm still trying to live into. Jua, Rojo is spiritual, what I'm still trying to grow into. Jua Osundu, Jua is the sun, because I've always had a lot of energy. So people say, man, yeah, you definitely got this thing going on with the sun. Jua, and Osundu is one who tires not from the efforts to improve or enhance life. And Eagle Heart is what is called a sun dancer. And that speaks to my spirituality that's connected to indigenous roots as a sun dancer with the Lakota Nation. Abdul Mu'id is servant of God, the Restorer, which is the 59th name of God in Islam or in Sufism. And as I was speaking to your daughter earlier, all those names are important, but I guess if someone says, okay, you only get two names and say, I would say Abdul Mu'id. Why? Because I'm making my connection to the Most High, and I am specifying the role, the mission, the purpose that I see myself serving and living into and attempting to fulfill. Servant of God, the Restorer.
And that is that's truly fascinating, man. At what point did you like come to an understanding that your name needed to be changed? Like what was it that gave you that, you know, that like, I can't do this anymore kind of feeling?
I never felt totally connected to my English name. However, recently I just found out that the meaning of my English name means woods. It means a river by the woods, or woods by the river. And interestingly enough, I was raised in a back off the main street where I didn't have running water. I had an outhouse. We had a big pot belly stove. You have to put wood in it, string of lights. And if you look at that, if you were to go there, you would say, oh, this must be in Mississippi, or this must be in Alabama. It was right here in New Jersey.
Interesting.
And it was a stream. It wasn't a river, but it was a stream. So even though I rejected the external aspect of my name, the internal part was very relevant to my life. In fact, where I live now, in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, behind my house, there's a stream. So it's this thing about me being next to water in a wooded area has been throughout my life, or a very big part of my life. So I went to Pratt Institute in 1973 to study industrial engineering. Pratt Institute is in Brooklyn, New York. Mm. Also in Brooklyn, New York, at the time was an organization called the East. And the East predominant, a premier black national cultural nationalist organization that had its own school, UNOSASA. It had its own cooperative, Kununuwana. It had a clothing store. It was like a little mini nation, right? Mm. On a very micro level, but it was African-centered. It was using what was called Kawaida, tradition and reason. And we said identity, purpose, and direction. So that's when I started to say, and that's when I found, that's really where actually before that I knew I was African, but I hadn't taken any concrete steps. So it was at the East that Onaje Jua was the first iteration of my name or of my becoming. And then it became Onaje Rojo Jua Osundu. And then over the years, different things just got added on because of my experiences. But it's been quite a journey to have that be a part of my life. And there's other people who gave up their so-called European names and then reverted back.
Hmm.
That's been an interesting kind of thing to watch as well, where they couldn't. Sometimes they say, you know, too black, too strong, where they couldn't live in that African centered space. It just, you know, their brainwashing was so intense that they couldn't appreciate the gift that they were given, and they accepted it at first and then they rejected it.
That is interesting, man. Have people, like, have you had trouble with people, like, with since you changed your name, as far as, you know, people rejecting you or trouble getting work and things like that?
Not really. You know, my father used to tease me a lot. He's not here, you know, and pray to be pleased with him. But once he saw I wasn't budging, after a while, he stopped kidding around, you know, making fun of it. And, you know, here, eat your ham sandwich, you know.
That is fascinating.
I don't eat pork no more, bro. You know.
Man, that is interesting, man. Really interesting, especially reversing the names back, man. And the East, man, we might have to do a whole episode on the East, man, because, you know, even in New York, I feel like a lot of New Yorkers don't know about the work that the East done and how they, you know, just really made some noise in the whole Black educational space. So we definitely got to do some work on the East. But going back into your own experience, man, let's dive into you growing up, man, like your early life and everything. I know eventually you went into Harlem and all of that, but what was happening before then, and then your transitioning period, and then obviously growing up in Harlem?
Yeah. I was born in North Carolina, actually, on a base that I found out was named after a very racist dude, Fort Bragg. But anyway, there's a whole struggle now to change the name of the base, because I haven't done extensive research, but I was born in North Carolina and then came up to New Jersey and Harlem. My mother was raised both in New Jersey and New York. My father was raised in New Jersey. So the early years of my life, I remember, what I remember is living with my father's mother, my grandma. In a small town close to New Jersey, which is about maybe 40 minutes from the George Washington Bridge. But that's the place I had mentioned earlier where I didn't have any running water. We had a well, we had an outhouse, and very menial, you know, in terms of material possessions, but it was a lot of love there. Right. I felt loved, I felt secure. It was an incredible journey. So 1959, we lost the property, eminent domain. The water company came in, dispersed everybody that was on that part of the land. And then I went to live with my mother in New York, 145th Street between Amsterdam and Broadway. And it was two different worlds, the world of nature and sunshine and animals and water and fresh, clean air, to Harlem, pollution, pigeons, crowded, people screaming. It was like, man, I was depressed for at least 2 years.
Wow. And then how old were you when you moved?
I was 7.
Wow. Man, so you're in Harlem now, and walk us through that time. This is Harlem, you know, a while back. Walk us through that time frame, man. What was Harlem like at that point in time? And, you know, how was when you started transitioning into just that experience?
It was fighting, you know, and it wasn't fighting like I was fighting in Closter. It was a whole different kind of fighting. And I mean, it was like fighting to like really hurt you. Like not to win, but to hurt you is a difference. And I had to learn a different way of fighting. I was always short, so I had to learn to put bottles near garbage cans and sticks in case somebody wanted to, you know, get busy. I was able to defend myself. So I had to be a different kind of person. Mm. Because when you're in a natural environment, you're part of nature. You feel in harmony. You feel supported. And you feel like you have a place, like that bee or like that turtle or like that snake. You feel you have a place in the social arrangement of things, in the natural arrangement of things. But when you come into a place like Harlem, you don't have a place. And everything you get, you got to earn. And it just made me just very depressed, you know, for 2 years. So I lived on 145th Street between Amsterdam and Broadway. And then we moved to the Bronx with my family. And that was another level of alienation because I didn't know anybody. At least when I was in Harlem, I knew my neighbors. When we went to the Bronx, we didn't know anybody. I mean, zero. And that was where I experienced my first major death. My best friend OD'd in the fifth grade.
Wow. OD'd?
OD'd in the fifth grade.
Wow. That's OD'd. I can't even imagine a fifth grader, you know.
Fifth grade. Oh, yeah.
Wow. That's fascinating, man. What?
So, yeah.
What was your friend kind of like dealing with for him to even be doing drugs on that level?
Yeah, his sister molested him.
Wow, man.
And that time we didn't know anything about therapy. You know, we didn't know what to do. You know, when he told me that, it was like, what? And my, you know, I have the idea that it was him just trying to resolve that. Like, wait a minute, why would my sister do this to me? And then I moved, so I never knew anything other than that. But I remembered his name. We used to call him Rusty. You know, I remember that for the years. So early in life, things started to happen. And
how did you deal with that trauma at that moment, though, man? Like you're still a kid, and your good friend just, you know, his life is just ended just like that. And you don't think about that as a kid that can happen. So how did you kind of deal with that? And how did that grief, connect in your head?
Grief, man. It was just the grief of losing my best friend. It was the grief. And then I moved from the Bronx back to New Jersey with my father. Mm. And so it's like, you know, it was all like a movie. you go to a movie and you turn the channels.
Right.
That's what my life was. It was like, you know, every 2 years and like the channel would change. Like who I would be living with would change. So I never had like the stability to really kind of like be whole and complete. I always felt that something was missing because something that I didn't get or something that I didn't bring or something that got left behind never really got balance to say, this is really me. And it was really my sixth grade teacher, her name is Miss Truth, who said that, you know, you can ask questions. You know, I'm really silent in school. So the way that losing my friend and moving back around just made me very silent, man. I just wouldn't talk too much at all.
Wow. So when she told you can ask questions, like that kind of opened up Pandora's box for you, you know.
Yeah, really. And then I started, you know, asking questions. And so from sixth grade to 12th grade, you can say that was a pretty fairly stable period of my life because I was going to the England public school system, right? But in ninth grade, when things were kind of going well, in ninth grade, come home from school, all my stuff was put out on the street.
Wow. Was that an eviction?
Yeah.
Wow.
yeah, my family stuff was all in the street. And it was like, now I'm back living with my mother in New York again. So it's this back and forth thing, back and forth, back and forth. So ninth grade, it was the middle of ninth grade. And my mother was a barmaid. So all I had to do was, she said, you know, she'd come home from work, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. She would say, you up? I'm up. She would go to sleep. I might go to sleep or I might go to my girlfriend's house. So I impregnated my first young woman at the age of 17. And both families decided to have an abortion.
Wow.
But you know, when you grow up in Harlem and maybe any predominantly Black urban setting, you know, you get exposed to certain rites of passage. Right. And usually that's drugs and usually that's sex.
Right.
And I got, you know, exposed to both. But didn't get strung out, you know, smoked marijuana, cocaine, heroin. And I'm not saying I'm any better than anyone else. I never shot up. But in my junior year, there was a gifted ball player named Billy Tinsley, OD'd in the park in Englewood, New Jersey. And he was like the most gifted ball player, and he was gone. Mm. He was gone. So along the way, I'm losing these people, you know? So you can probably see why I became a social worker, you know?
Right. I was just about to say that, like, that's really interesting. It seems like your life could have went, you know, left or right. And
hey, I could have OD'd, you know, I could have been shot. All the different things that happened to my friends, all those things could have happened to me. So I do feel that I have an obligation to do what I do because I got by. Some kind of way all the stuff didn't really impact me to the point of, really significantly impairing my life.
Mm. Man, that's interesting, man. Especially having to deal with all of that. Like, I would understand if you would have said, like, I OD'd or I got into this, I got into that. Like, that would make a lot of sense because of everything that you dealt with as far as kind of the work you do now. Like we just said, like with trauma and pain and all of that, like, especially at a young age, I feel like a lot of young people and even parents don't even know where to begin when their children are dealing with trauma and pain. And the kids don't know where to begin. So it's just like, you understand sometimes when kids get strung out or when children have a lot of babies or the violence and all that kind of stuff. And you're like, well, you know, look at how they were raised. Look at the upbringing, you know, they were, you know, in a monstrous environment, you know? Yeah, I find it fascinating that you were able to really allow that to create, you know, something positive out of that whole experience. But you mentioned that at 17, 18, the woman that you got pregnant did not go through with the full term.
Yeah, she didn't. We didn't, you know, it was a decision both families. And her mother was in the North where she was really raised in the South, but in the South she had already had someone in mind that she intended to marry, and she wound up marrying that person. I don't know if she ever mentioned to him, you know, that she was pregnant or, you know, decided to have the abortion, but she was like about a year older than me. So that was one. And then being young and just stupid, you know, I wound up in another relationship, getting another girl pregnant.
Wow, this is back to back.
Pretty much. Graduated high school in 1970. My daughter was born in December of 1970. So working as a fatherhood coordinator now is me trying to give some information to some young brothers and sisters, young brothers particularly, things which I didn't know, which I wish I did know or was taught at that age. So it's almost like a spiritual debt that I'm trying to play. You know, I mean, if I had more information, you know, maybe I would have waited longer, you know, before having sex. Maybe I'd have been more responsible in terms of using protection. But it was, it for whatever reason, it wasn't something that I did. And the consequence, right, to both of them, I don't know all of it, but I know that I was able to go back to school and get a college degree. And the woman of my first child who was born, very intelligent young woman, and I'm sure that she would have lived a different life if I hadn't gotten her pregnant. Mm-hmm. Right, when I did, she probably would have lived a whole different life because she could very, very intelligent. She probably went to college and she'd have probably been another like Nikki Giovanni or something because she was a poet.
Wow.
So these are some of my regrets and these are some of the things I'm trying to repair because, you know, I'm the one that created that situation. And I'm the one who has to take responsibility. Some of my life work is trying to correct those things.
So with the fatherhood, did you, you know, you were a young man, did you take responsibility and kind of do what you had to do? Or was it a difficult process just getting everything together?
I assumed all the responsibilities that I thought I, you know, could do at the time because I was wanting to go to school. And she and I had agreed. We had broken up. We got back together, wound up breaking up again. At one point, in fact, my daughter came to live with me. But I don't want to skip over the point that when you're young, there's so many things that you don't know. And when you start taking advice from your peers, you're in trouble. You know, they were saying, no, don't put his name on the birth certificate. Because if you do that, you don't know where to catch him. And I didn't have any money. So it was just this whole thing of thinking from lack, right, that propelled me and her. So it was an agreement, right? It wasn't something that I did on my own, but I'm not going to put the burden on her, even though they came to her when she had the baby and said, who's the father? And she said she didn't know or unknown, but that was because of a conversation we had, but we were both young and didn't, you know, speak to our parents about what we were doing, right? We didn't speak to the elders. So being disconnected, that was a regret that one of the biggest regrets of my life, because that sweet child, Taisha, was on this planet only for 25 years. She committed suicide in 1996, and I always wonder, what did her mother say to her when she, I guess she had to give her a birth certificate, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know what those conversations were like. And the mother could have said there's something that I didn't want to own, which wasn't true. I never said she wasn't my daughter. That was never the case. But I don't know the impact that it had on my daughter. So she was out of my life for 12 years, actually, from six to 18. Wow. And when she came back into my life, you know, I said, Ty, we have to go down to City Hall and get your birth certificate straight. But I wanted to be really mindful and wanted to be, I didn't really want to be too pushy or too hard and make, you know, but then again, maybe I should have, because it didn't happen. And if I would have done that, would that have made a difference in my daughter's life? And would she still be here? I don't know these things. So that was young, foolish, uninformed, that had a very it had a deep consequence. How deep, and was it connected to a suicide? I don't know. But I do know that I do regret that I didn't have my name on her birth certificate. And I didn't, when she came back into my life, I didn't make sure that she had my name on it at that point.
Man, I'm at a loss for words, man. Just your whole experience, man. Everything that you just mentioned has just been trauma and pain, and then trauma and pain and more of that. So I'm just thinking, like, at what point, like, what was it that kind of gave you the realization that you need to self-repair and heal and address your trauma? Like, what was that moment like for you where you got the idea, like, you know, I'm at a point in life where I need to repair myself because my whole life has been trauma and pain? Like, you know, when did that happen, and what was your process of self-reparation?
Well, I don't know the answer to the questions. I don't know. But thinking about it, I remember going to a play, and the play was El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, The Life and Times of Malcolm X by N.R. Davidson. And I had said, if this is what Black theater is about, I definitely want to be about this. So after that, I read Autobiography of Malcolm X. No, actually, I read Malcolm X Speaks first. Mm-hmm. Then after I read Autobiography. But the two people that gave me an idea of manhood was Malcolm X and George Jackson. And when I started to read their works, I was like, wow, man, these brothers are deep, they're bad. So it challenged me to say, if they can do this stuff behind bars, if they can make their life meaning this from where they came from, you know, what are you going to do with your life? Mm. And as a result of going to the play, signing up to be an actor, in fact, then being told that Alvin Ailey was hiring a light and sound technician trainee, and traveling with the world's best known dance group, the Alvin Ailey Dance Company, traveling with them for about 2 years. Hmm. But I knew after traveling around the country and having a lived nationalist experience, not from reading the book, not from somebody telling me something, but actually seeing it with my own eyes, seeing Black people in our genius and in our foolishness, I knew then that we were a nation. And I knew then we had everything we needed to do to liberate ourselves. Only thing is that they didn't know it. You know, my people didn't have the experience of traveling around the country and meeting all kinds of people in all different kinds of positions. So many of our people only have the consciousness and information of their neighborhood. Some people in New York City, in the Bronx, never been to Brooklyn. Some people in Brooklyn never been to Staten Island. Some people in Staten Island never been to Queens. It's like we still have this plantation mentality.
Right, absolutely.
So I had an opportunity to travel, and I had the opportunity to learn things and see things. And when I came back to New York, I knew that I was given something really special. So self-repair meant self-repair of myself, and it meant self-repair of my people. And only one solution could actually address both of that, and that was liberation. Mm. So I became a community activist revolutionary from the point of view of the people I read, the people I studied, the things I did. So tying it back to Afro-American Studios for Acting Speech in Harlem under Ernie McClintock, and it was a Black-centered, it was a Black theater company. And these men had consciousness about themselves and about what they wanted to offer to the community. As a result of that, I followed suit. And then when I went to Brooklyn, right, to go to school and then becoming a member of the East Organization, that was another level of identity, of purpose and direction. learning about Kwanzaa, learning about the seven principles.
Wow. And how old are we talking at this point?
73, I was about 22, 23.
Okay.
And then I stayed in Brooklyn up until 80, came back to, so when I left Brooklyn, I didn't have my bachelor's degree in engineering, but I did have a PhD in Black nationalism. Right. Even when I was going to school as an industrial engineer student, I was still traveling around the country because they had what is called a cooperative education program. And I never forget, you know, Malcolm X saying, travel broadens one's scope. So here I am traveling around the country first with Alvin Ailey, then traveling around the country again as an engineering student in the cooperative education program. But every time I went to those assignments, I would always connect to the independent African community, particularly those that was created at independent schools through what was called CB, the Council of Independent Black Institutions. So every time I traveled, I'm learning people, I'm meeting people, and all that raised my consciousness. And then when I read the work of Amilcar Cabral, and there's no way that I'm going to compare myself to him, but I will say we had similar experiences. Mm. He was an agricultural engineer. I went to study industrial engineering. He traveled around Africa, particularly around Guinea-Bissau. I traveled around the country, and I was comparing how our lives were similar in those ways. No, I'm certainly not ideologue to, because he was a revolutionary leader of the PAIGC, and he was assassinated. But I saw how it was like, how he used engineering to organize the people. So every place I would organize and make connections in any way that I can. And many of those connections are still in place. So, mm-hmm. So the course of this exposure and the people I met along the way, that I am who I am.
That is remarkable, man. Absolutely remarkable. So with the engineering, at what point did you understand that your calling was in social work? And what did that mean to you at that point?
Like I started the Black Student Unit at Dwight Moore High School.
Mm.
I was the chair of the Black Student Unit at Pratt Institute. I was the chair, I was the president of the student government. So I was always bringing the social movement aspect to whatever I did. So it wasn't me saying I don't want to be an engineer anymore, but I had spent so much time at the East and spent so much time organizing. I was just burnt out. I needed to take a break. So when I took a break, I wound up working for a Puerto Rican group called Arawak in El Barrio in East Harlem. And when I found myself in that environment, I really liked what I was experiencing, what I was doing, working with young people, working with the youth. And then one thing kind of led to another. Then I wound up working for FaZe Piggyback, which was an organization in Harlem that started off attending to the drug problem. And it started off Operation Open Hand, then it became FaZe Piggyback. So I joined them in 1986. And the funny thing about it was when I first moved to Harlem, I lived at 506 West 145th Street, and they were right across the street at 507. So it was almost like, but when I came back to Harlem, I'm coming back with all the information that I learned at the East from 1973 to 1980. So I'm coming back with Kwanzaa, I'm coming back with the Ghouls of Saba, I'm coming back with the songs, I'm coming back with all these different parts of it. And that was then fully accepted into by the people at FaZe Piggyback. In fact, I say to folks that I lived the life that most Black men can't even dream about. And they say, why would you say that? Because for 25 years, I've worked under two progressive Black men, Abu Karim Shabazz from FaZe Piggyback from 1986 to 2000. And from 2004 to 2015, I worked with Reality House under Leonard A. Bear. And the last year he had left, but for those 10 years I worked on him. So how many Black men had worked for another Black man? How many Black men have worked for two progressive Black men? How many Black men have worked for two progressive Black men for 25 years?
Wow. I've never thought about that. That is a sad concept, man. I never thought about that. Wow.
How many Black men have worked for a Black man ever in life who was progressive and tied their work to the liberation of our people? So you can see that I've been given a lot. Yes, I've experienced traumas, tragedy, pain, and suffering, but also I've experienced tremendous love and acceptance and some great teachers like Irvin Davis, the founder of Pan-African Skills Project, and also co-chair of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, like Majani Enrifu, who was an aeronautical engineer, but also a Pan-Africanist who created the Pan-Africanist Human Frame of Reference in terms of teaching science and technology. You know, Hannibal Afrique out of Chicago, right? I can go down the list of the people I've met and their influence, impact on me. And so I accept the teachings and I accept the responsibility. Bob Knox, who was the president of Association of Black Social Workers in Harlem, New York for over 25 years.
Interesting. So as we dive into social work now, what is like your functional definition of social work? Because I feel like, you know, I see many different jobs of social workers. What exactly are social workers supposed to be doing? Like, what is the definition of that? And then I know you were a part of the Black Association of Social Workers. So why was that necessary to have that kind of Black perspective of it? And why didn't it fit into the general context of what social work means in regards to what it normally is?
Social work as a profession came out of the child welfare system, what was called settlement houses, the visiting persons who used to go to people's houses. So it's just a combination of different things coming together. But the field basically is a field that has been put in place as a cap, to reduce the pressure, right? When there were times when social workers attempted to be proactive and social justice oriented, what was called the rank and file social workers in the 40s. In the 60s, you had a movement, you had a welfare movement around the country where the welfare workers were organizing and they got pushed off the roll. So you can see anytime the field sided with the poor, the disenfranchised, the oppressed, anytime those things started to come into being, there was always the movement to push them out, to fire them, to get rid of them. If you look at the curriculums of most social work schools, very few schools have social work and the community organizing aspect. At one time, that was a big feature. So you can see that there's been an orchestrated process to disengage social work from social movement. The National Association of Black Social Workers, seeing that their demands weren't being met in 1968, when they were part of the dominant white social work organization, they pulled out of it in California. And that's when the National Association of Black Social Workers was formulated. And from then, they've been building chapters ever since, of which I'm still a member and will be a lifetime member. So my definition of social work for me as an African here in America is the social organizing advocacy and helping skills directly towards liberation of African people.
Mm. Now, you know, I've heard a lot of different understandings and definitions of what liberation for African people means. So when you say that, what is that picture for, you know, that you paint in your head when you say liberation of African people?
Liberation for African people means, one, that Africa must be united and must be self-determining, that they have control over themselves in terms of the nation state or the continental wide nation state, that they will have created their own constitution. They would have total control of their resources, and they'll be interacting in such a manner that they'll be safeguarding those resources in the future of their children for at least seven generations. Mm-hmm. So as a Pan-Africanist, what I intend to do, what I have attempted to do, is to make those alliances with brothers and sisters here in the United States, as well as on the continent, in terms of how can we unite Africa and how can we liberate Africa. So liberation for Africans here in the United States really has three levels or three phases. There are Black people who want to be a part of this country. And you might say that's the camp, like Martin Luther King, right? There's another group of African people here who feel that they want to have their own nation state, the Republic of Provisional Government of Republic of New Africa, which claims the five states where our people have sweat and died and worked in and have a right to that land. And then there's another group of Africans that want to repatriate to go back to Africa. So liberation has to have a comprehensive understanding of all three possibilities, political possibilities. The minute we discard and deny another part of us to what they want for themselves, that's almost like them denying us the right that we want to have for ourselves.
Mm.
The question becomes, to what degree do the other fragments stand in the way of another group's ambitions? And that's what we have to work out. So we have to first have political pluralism amongst ourselves. If we as a people agree that these are the three choices that we have before us, and any one of us can choose any one of those choices, but we're not going to let anyone stand in our way of denying any one of us whatever choice they make for themselves.
Mm. Yeah, that is interesting. Out of all those three, which one do you most identify with?
Well, I would have to say, physically where I am, I'm still here physically in the United States under this nation state. Actually, it's a multinational state. So I identify because I'm here. But at some point I do, my wife had talked about going to Ghana because her daughter's married to somebody from Ghana. So we're thinking about going to get Ghana. But if I had my ideal, I would have a home somewhere in the Caribbean. I would have a home somewhere in the United States, and I would have a home in Africa. And I would to move from any one of those three as circumstances, you know, would dictate. But I do believe that that more so, much of our political work is tied to what is called a plebiscite. And this is, I was taught this by Imari Obadeli, that when did our people consent never consented. How can you tell me that democracy starts with informed consent when we never consented and never got informed? So
when you say consent, what do you mean? Consent to what exactly?
People have told you you're an American citizen. How did you become a citizen? How did you become a citizen? So I just wrote a piece of paper because you was born here? No, we never had a plebiscite. We never had an organized voting, international observed and sanctioned mechanism for our people to vote what we want our relationship to be. And I'm saying those three choices must be made available to us.
Yeah, that is fascinating, man. Even I have heard you say even the very beginning of the American, the African American or Caribbean American or whatever, Latino American, the separation from, you know, connecting those two pieces together identifies that we're not American, you know, or else we would just be American. So that's even in the language, you know, and beyond the consent as well. You know, that's really interesting.
Yeah, the 14th Amendment didn't make a citizen. It's just, it's superimposed citizenship. You can invite someone to citizenship, but you can't superimpose it. And because our people aren't educated, politically educated, astute enough to understand the fullness of that, we remain subjects of the state, subordinate to the state. And that's a part of our struggle right now is in terms of political education. So when Malcolm X said that our struggle is not a civil rights struggle, it's a human rights struggle. What he was saying is that we need to understand what is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? What is the covenant on civic and political rights? What is the covenant on social and cultural rights? See, when we understand these things, we can think in international terms. As long as we think underneath a usurped United States frame of reference, we'll always be subordinated because we are brought here to be subordinated, and they have that change, that position. Now, yes, you can be a proxy racist and you can work in their system and you can advance their system. They'll let you do that. But as far as self-determination, no, that's not an option. Why? Because they want to continue the falsification of saying that America is a nation. America is not a nation. A nation is just a group of people that have a common history, a common language, a common background, as we have. A nation state is when that nation formulates a political construct that allows them to say that they have a certain position in the world in relationship to other nation states. But America is a multi-nation state. We have many nations in the state, but we're not taught this. So therefore, we don't get a chance to exercise those human rights that you would be able to exercise if you stood up for them. But you can't stand up for something that you don't know about. That's why Malcolm X was so dangerous, because he was, and King was also, King was starting to say the same thing. Right. It was King who said that Black people are living in domestic colonies. Right. But people don't know that part of King. So much of our work has to do with the political education. And this is why the Panthers were such a threat, because they were providing that political education to bring these things forward.
So what do you say to the person that's like listening and they're like, all right, Dr. Onaji, like you're talking about African liberation, Pan-Africanism, but we also know the ideologies of Malcolm X was like similar, and the Black Panthers and, you know, Martin Luther King, the people that you've mentioned, and we know what happened to them. You know, white folks are just not going to allow this thing to happen. So why even try? Why even, you know, have this concept of something that is not going to become a reality? What do you say to people that have that mindset?
I say to them, you have a choice to be a man, to be a woman, and demand your human rights right here on this earth, right now. Or you can acquiesce and be a pawn and a subject of someone else's system. That is your choice. But when you're making that choice, understand you are condemning your children to the same situation that you found yourself in. And, mm-hmm. and is that all you want to give to your children? Or do you want to give them the legacy of a Malcolm X, the legacy of a Dr. Martin Luther King, the legacy of a Mary McLeod Bethune, the legacy of all our heroes and sheroes who constantly fought for our liberation, a W.E.B. Du Bois, a Carter G. Woodson. When we know what our people have done before us, we can, in fact, assume responsibility. And there's a difference between history and heritage. This is it. History is just knowing facts and figures and people and places. Heritage, when you understand what they were saying, what they were doing, and you join on to that. So we have always been fighting for our liberation. That has never stopped. We're not taught that. We're not taught in our churches. We're not taught in our mosques. We're not taught it in schools. But just because we haven't been taught it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means we just don't know about it. So Everyone has a right to choose their contribution on this earth to themselves, to their family, to their community, to the world. So African people are in a place that the world is waiting for us. The world looks for us certainly for sports, for culture, for music. Mm-hmm. But inside of that, they know that there's a certain genius that's present and hasn't risen. The world is waiting for us to be the men, to be the African people that we are.
Right. Yeah, well said, well said. So I know a big experience for you along with human rights was you going into the United Nations Conference Against Racism in South Africa. So what was that experience like for you? And then what was your take on where we're at globally with that ideology of human rights and fighting against racism as a collective Black people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a delegate to the United Nations World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa in 2001, representing ICRAM, which is the International Human Rights Association of American Minorities, which was the NGO that Malcolm X helped create, in that he worked with Dr. Yusuf Clyde, who was the founder of ICRAM. So I went as the UN representative for ICRAM to that world conference. And also at the time I was the international chair, as I mentioned earlier, I was international chair for ACOBA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. And listen, to go someplace where you can hear Black people speaking in one voice through the language of French, through the language of English, through the language of Portuguese, through the language of Spanish, was incredible. I've never experienced something like that, because at the United Nations, you have interpreters who will, whoever's speaking, they'll interpret that person's language into your native language. So you have earphones on where, and all our people are saying the same exact thing, that how they are living and how they're being treated by the nation states they find themselves was similar. Their voting rights were being abridged. They were the first fired, the last hired. Education opportunities were shrinking. Mm-hmm. All places in the world where African people are living, particularly outside of Africa, they were saying the same exact story. If they were in Brazil, if they were in Honduras, if they was in Germany, if they were in Sweden, if they was in Switzerland, they were saying the same thing. It was an incredible thing to witness. And also know that many of the countries there in South Africa declared slavery a crime against humanity. the majority nation of the world admitted that what happened to our people was one of the greatest type of crimes that could have ever been committed. It's only three major crimes: genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. That our people still don't know it to today, that the crime was so big that it was an affront to all of humanity. That's how big this crime was. We haven't been informed of that. We haven't digested that. What's the meaning of that? Think about it. When the Jews say never again, and they don't let an opportunity go by without them bringing up the Holocaust. If there's any place for them to insert it, they will tell you that this will never happen again to them.
Right.
However, whatever their numbers are, which is minuscule. Now, if you compare the number of Jewish, and particularly talking about the ones who usurped the Jewish religion, the Hebrew religion, and call themselves Jews, the number of them, I don't know what it is, but I know it's vastly different and minuscule compared to the number of African people. So for them to have that concept of affirming their right to declare what happened to them, genocide, and we don't have that same right and we're not using it, you can imagine the level of social movement would occur when our people begin to realize what happened to us was a crime against humanity. If there was a crime, there was a criminal. If there's a criminal, there was a victim. If there's a victim, there was a harm. If it's a harm, it must be repaired, and it must be reparations now. Our people are not moving forward because we haven't made the demand.
Now, I understand what you're saying. But how do we get to that position of realization where the opportunities for realization have been blocked, where we look at the education system, where they don't even want to touch racism. They don't want to touch the true meaning of slavery. They don't want to touch the Black Holocaust and things of that sort. And even if they do touch it, would it be in the same context as it coming from us? So how do you deal with that when all the major sectors?
It's our responsibility.
So
our children live in our homes.
So what I'm asking is, how do we
They go to bed in our.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
They wake up in the same household. We have to take responsibility for educating our
children. We cannot,
Yes, we can still fight for those things to happen, but we abrogated much of our own responsibility where we're not teaching these things ourselves.
But absolutely.
We can't expect other people to teach us what we should be teaching ourselves.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with what it is that you're saying. But when we have like a majority of people that don't even know, that don't even sometimes care to know or have a deep understanding that we are in the position that we're in and what the historical evidence has been, for the human rights violations and things of that sort, where do the people like you, like how do you distribute that information to people in the sense that they're gonna listen and have an understanding where their entire reality and their entire all the systems that they're in is telling them that it wasn't a big deal. The Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust was more important than it was more you should have empathy for that, but not empathy for your own people kind of thing. So
we said at the East, we said educate, agitate, and organize. And it's still educate, agitate, and organize. There's no other way. Frederick Douglass said that it may be a moral struggle, it may be a physical struggle, but it must be a struggle because power never conceded without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Where there is no struggle, there is no progress. Martin Luther King said that progress is not inevitable and change is not guaranteed. You must engage in social action. So all our organizations, even though they might have different goals or different endpoints, all of them were attempting to agitate and organize and create social movements. If you talk about NAACP, if you talk about CORE, yeah, their integration into organizations, but I'm saying they were always trying to organize the people. And that still is what is going to be the turning point. George Floyd, right? Our people took to the streets. And as a result of taking the streets all across the country, everybody's talking. You've never heard equity as much as you've heard it in the last 2 years. You have never heard it said as much. Mm-hmm. Why? Because of the social movement. It was spontaneous, as they usually are, but it's not sustained. That's why we have to continue to organize and invite people to different organizations. I'm not telling anyone to join any organization in particular. I'm saying join a organization just so you can start to think in an organized manner. And that's how we are, that's how we get held in place, because we're not taking action. And sometimes that's referred to as waking the sleeping giant. But the other part, that the thing which we're not told, there are many young people who are taking some very bold, very intentional steps to organize their neighborhoods. But because it's not on the nightly news, you don't know about these people. Mm. I just met a brother in Philadelphia who is organizing against the trafficking of our young girls. But he said to me, it's not just human trafficking, isn't just those sector, but our young people going to jail from the school, the prison pipeline, that's part of the human trafficking as well. I mean, he just opened up a whole new branch, you know, of my thinking about what human trafficking is. There are a lot of young people who are doing some tremendous things without a general environment of social activism. See, when I grew up, I had Nation Islam, I had the Panthers, I had the US organization, I had all these organizations, it was active. So I had many choices. Right now, those choices don't seem to be as plentiful or don't seem available, but they are. So in spite of the lack of an overall social movement that's taking place, young people are still doing some really impressive things. So I still have great hope, trust, and confidence that we are going to move through this period. And what sustains me is, if our people were in chattel slavery, where you were a dog, a mule, a sex object, with no rights, no rights at all, and if we were able to join the Union Army, in fact, we joined both sides and we secured our own liberation. If we were able to get out of that, to me, there's nothing that we can't get out of.
Agreed, definitely. And so a lot of that, the history component of it, you identify as, you know, the historical trauma that we face. You know, we know Dr. Joy DeGruy calls it post-traumatic slavery syndrome. How do we get, you know, past some of the things that have been passed down from generation to generation, like some of the fear and then the way that it reproduces? I know one of the major areas that you focus in is on violence prevention and things of that sort, but it has reproduced itself in our anger, where we don't really know why we're angry, but we're angry. You know, and we see another Black person, you know, and then it's time to take out my rage, kind of thing. So how do we start to heal from that historical trauma and, you know, build a sense of, you know, I guess self-healing, so that it won't dive into the mental illness and it won't dive into the violence and it won't dive into some of the issues that we have?
Yeah, I think the first place to start is to acknowledge historical resilience. Our people are phenomenal. All that we went through, and we can still smile at each other, we can still speak to each other, we can still want to be married and still want to have babies and still want to, you know, contribute to life. The mere fact that those sentiments are still inside of us and still being played out every day is a testimony to who we are and how great we are. That isn't to say that there hasn't been consequences, and scathing consequences as that, as a result of the oppression. But we have to first start by acknowledging the power and the brilliance and the genius that has sustained us through all these centuries. So we have to start there with historical resilience. And as we learn about all these heroes and sheroes and the things they did, we begin to say, how did they do that? And I mean, Marcus Garvey organized 6 million people in the 20s around the world without the internet. How do you organize 6 million people in the 1920s?
Even with internet, that's like fascinating. So imagine.
It happened because we still love each other in spite of all the things we've done to each other. There's still a great love that we have for each other.
Right.
And we have to keep raising that up. So we start with historical resilience, and then we start to build what I call social health circles, where a small group gets together and starts to share who they are, what they're about. Keep doing that over time. Start to exchange resources and information. One person may be good in computers, another person may be good in math. Well, I'll teach your daughter arithmetic, and I need you to cut my lawn. We start to barter our skills with each other. And then we create what is called a SUSU. SUSU is an economic system that is still being used in Africa and many places in the Caribbean, where you have 10 people and everybody puts in $100 a week and it goes around and it keeps going around. So everybody gets it. But I'm saying add another chair. So if let's say you had 3 people and they put in $25 and then they put in another $8, so they will create another $25. And when it comes around to that fourth person, it'll be for a project that they want to do in the community. So we have to learn to build trust again, you see? Much of our dilemma has to do with we don't trust each other.
Right.
And the only way that you build trust is through relationship and through consistency, through dependency, through predictability. So I'm creating the social health circles that starts through that. There are many SUSUs that's and I'm a part of one. But the more we localize our work, it becomes real and becomes tangible. But then we're connected with people of like, and it also means people of like mind. You have to work with people of like minds who can see these things. And there's a number of small movements here and there that I see taking place. So the question which you're really asking, how do we liberate our people? Liberate our people by creating relationships and opportunities for healing, right? We have to, there's an African saying that says you must reveal to heal. We have to say, I am hurting. We have to be able to say that, I haven't gotten over with my father's death, or I haven't gotten over with my, whatever has happened to you, be able to come to a place where you can say those things and with no blame, no shame, no judgment. And because we have the National Association of Black Social Workers, the National Association of Black Psychologists, the National, you have a Black Psychiatrist Association. Those organizations are existing almost like in their own area, right? But now those areas are starting to come together, are starting to form. And COBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations America, is working with the social workers, working with the psychologists. We just finished coming out with a report that's called the Harm Report, right? Looking at the epigenetic harm, the epigenetic negative inheritance that we have as a result of centuries of oppression. So now we're beginning to use the education that we've gained to fully analyze the situation that we're in, and then tracing it all the way back to the beginnings of slavery so that we can make a new demand for reparations. But we have to know these things as a people, but our dignity is tied up with knowing these things and demanding redress. We can't wait on anyone to heal us. We have to heal ourselves, and we're not going to allow those responsible for our injury to be let off. So there's an international movement taking place. People on the continent demanding reparations. People in the Caribbean are demanding reparations. Our people here in the United States, there is an international movement taking place now on the demand of reparations. So where does the healing begin? The healing is at all levels. It's healing for the individual. It's healing for the family. It's healing for the community. It's healing for our people wherever we are. And it's healing for our people internationally through Pan-Africanism. And there are different formations taking place. Let me share with you that because of the liberation struggles in Africa, many of those nations that were former colonies of European countries are now so-called free with a nation, with a flag and debt, right? But as a member of the United Nations, they have been putting forward to have what is called a decade of people of African descent from 2015 to 2024, using the theme of recognition, justice, and development. Very astute themes to have, because once you are starting to think through the prism of recognition, justice, development, that's a liberation kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, we have now the permanent form for people of African descent, which is a form to look at the conditions of African people all around the world, basically outside of Africa. Now, just think about that. There's never been a body in the United Nations that has taken that on as its main and exclusive task to understand the conditions of African people around the globe, and then communicate that back to all the member nation states, and then have that inculcated in the different plans that they have, which is called Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. So we're in a place and time where our concerns as African people in the diaspora are being raised up as never before. Mm-hmm. This is the first time this has ever happened before. So yes, there are many things that we can be disheartened about, as we are about the shooting in Buffalo, in Texas. But that doesn't remove the dedicated people doing dedicated things consistently to raise our people up and to organize our people. And so the healing is to know that we're not alone. The healing is to know that I can come on your show and have this conversation, and somebody can see this and say, wait a minute, those are two brothers, they're kicking hard. But it's happening over and over again. So the more we know that we are doing, having these kinds of conversations and enlightening each other, supporting each other, the more people who are on the sidelines will be willing to say, okay, let me get involved. So how do we attend to the healing? By choosing the best in us, by looking at our heroes and sheroes, raising them up, learning from them, and then teaching it to our young, teaching our children in our own homes, teaching our children in the mosque, in the church, in the community centers. When we step up and step into those circles where people are and share what we have, things will continue to get better.
Man, I agree. Agreed, man. Thank you for those words, man. If we zoom in kind of a little bit, I know violence prevention has been a major part of your life, and you've done a lot of community work as it relates to helping communities heal with some of the effects of violence. And even this year right now, we're looking at the impacts of COVID, the gun, homicide, and suicide rate for Black boys and men aged 10 to 24 is more than 21 times that of white boys and white men in the same age group this year. So how do we kind of dissect that, and kind of what has been, I guess, your experience dealing with violence from that hands-on level to kind of deal with some of these things that I think a lot of us don't really deal with hands-on. Like, we do a lot of theory talk when it comes to this stuff, but you're in the community, you're talking to the former gang members that have done things and that are trying to, you know, repair the community again. So, you know, for the things that are happening right now, how do we seek a resolve for these Black boys that are resolving to violence?
There are a number of levels. One is that our people have to appreciate what public health is supposed to be and make it respond to our public health needs. Gun violence is a public health crisis. Therefore, it must be a public health approach. Cure violence is one of the methodologies that's used to apply a public health approach. It's a good start, but that's what it is, a good start. We have to go beyond that. We have to declare racism a public health crisis. When we declare in our localities, our cities, in our states, once we declare racism, and it's about 246 counties and municipalities that have done that already.
Right.
Once we continue to do that and make racism a public health crisis, then the next logical step is then we have to speak about historical trauma and how that is part and parcel of racism. That's the consequence of racism. And then once we have that in place, then the next answer is, what is the solution? The solution is only one solution, that's reparations. People in Evanston, Illinois, have started a reparations program. There's movements in Boston, Sacramento, California just finished passing a reparations bill. So I'm saying gun violence is connected to the social conditions of the people. Right. If you don't have good education, by default, you're going to go to the street. If you don't have good jobs, by default, you're going to succumb to the local economy. So most of the things, the environment in which we are forced in, which is an oppressive environment, gives people a choice by default to find themselves in those positions because other opportunities are not available. So when I did my doctorate work, we have something in social work that's called the Grand Challenges. And the only one that came closest to the one that could contain what my argument was under opportunity and justice, right? But it's not just opportunity. It's not just justice. It's really about self-determination. Because the people who don't have the right to determine their future is therefore living out a reality that someone else has prescribed for them. Oof. So gun violence is a part of the social political condition. In international terms, there's something which is called the peace dividend, where other entities will come into a situation and they will provide some type of sustenance, which is material, so the two combating forces will stop fighting. Well, we haven't applied that. I'm not saying that's the only solution, but that's another solution that can be applied. But you got to remember, there are people who like the fact that we are shooting each other. Gun manufacturers like the fact that that becomes a market for their sales. Police officers like the fact that these conditions exist because they can say, this is why you need them. You see, there are people who have vested interests in the situation, and we have to create scenarios where it's not to their advantage to have those things. We have to be able to look at a situation and provide a local solution from an international perspective in terms of what's available in the international world that could apply to that situation. So the peace dividend is a very, it's a highly political, international strategy that we have to call for. So any, if people can call for sending money to Ukraine, what relationship do we have with Ukraine? I have no idea, except the white folks, and white folks always want to get consideration. So if they can make this consideration for people living these thousand miles away, we're living in a war zone right in our own neighborhoods, but we have to demand it. Mm. Where there was no struggle, there's no progress.
Before we dip out, I kind of wanted to for you to touch base on what it is that you kind of want to leave as far as your legacy, and what you want people to think about when they think about your work.
Well, in the last 2 years, I've come to know that I've been given the gift of turtle medicine. And people say, well, what is that? It's the power to achieve a PhD, a doctorate in social work, a doctorate at the age of 68. Mm. I'm saying that to say that there's no one listening to this broadcast that has a legitimate reason for not pursuing his or her goals or ambitions. And why do I say that? I'm saying if I can get my doctorate at 68 years of age, and you can do anything way before 68. So I'm saying don't give up on yourself. I'm saying whatever's in your heart, you'll live it out. Surround yourself with people who is going to support you in that process, and never, never, never give up. Forward, ever, backward, never. And if anything I've said tonight is any at all, any part of a tiny bit of inspiration, my message to you is to love yourself, love your family. In the words of Sartre Sarkar, she says, we must love each other, we must protect each other. It's our duty to fight, it's our duty to win, because we have nothing to lose but our change.
Well said, man. You just addressed the last question I was going to ask you, which is your favorite quote and what it means to you. And you just answered it with Asada Shakur's quote, man. This was definitely I feel like a healing experience for me to listen to. And I'm inspired by your ability to find, your purpose through some of the experiences that you've had in your life, and not giving up and continuing to see a need for some of the things that you've been doing in our communities, man, and actual, doing things and not just, theoretical stuff, but actual active community things. So appreciate the work that you've done, man. And I know we're going to have multiple interviews on this platform because you have so much to share. So I can't wait to have you back, and just thank you for coming and hanging out with us and sharing some valuable, valuable information with us, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. I would like to say that the women in my life have been extremely instrumental. I can speak about my mother, Sylvia Oliver, who was a barmaid, went to night school 8 years, got a bachelor's degree in hospital management, and always said white folks was crazy, and I agree. every day. I can talk about My sister, who was adopted, and her mother, Florence Jenkins, who was a major influence in my life. Right, I can just go down the list. So even though I mentioned men, I wouldn't be telling the whole story if it wasn't for the women. My first wife, Naima. She was thinking about Naima, but she wound up in Niamo. Niamo Mui, my first wife, in terms of her contribution to my life. My current wife, Dr. Fatima Hafiz. My sister, Nadambi Jean Oliver. So I would not want to leave this interview without mentioning some of the women who made a major impact on my life. Mm-hmm.
Definitely appreciate that, man. It takes the yin and the yang, man, to produce, you know, the end product. So appreciate you mentioning those sisters. And again, appreciate you for coming on the program. And I, you know, I just have a feeling we'll be doing a lot of work together, man. So I appreciate everything you've been doing, man. And listeners, please share the program. I think a lot of us need to hear this type of information and have an understanding of the work that we need to do in regards to healing, self-discovery, and the idealization that we need to be free, and, you know, the process of doing so. So definitely share the program and check out Dr. Muid's work. Check out his other interviews and, you know, stay tuned because he will be back. And of course, remember, your mind is the most powerful tool in the universe. Therefore, if you can think it, you can do it. If you believe in it, you can be it. And if you fight for it, you can have it. The world is yours. This has been your host, Mr. G, and I will see you next time on Mastermind.